Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me on this Monday, October 6, 2014, for the Heretics Hour. I am Carolyn Yeager. Kind of by accident, I'm engaging in another sensitive subject tonight. It's like talking about race in the mainstream radio world. I have previously likened any discussion of differences among white people to being subject to the same political correctness that we find in the mainstream about race, the basic races. We are supposed to all be the same. And I guess in any group, you might run into the same type of feeling. Well, as I explained on the program announcement, Bob from D.C., who's also known as Wolf Wall Street, called into my program on Saturday and said he would have some comments about it. He said he thought it was good and interesting, but he wanted to, finish listening to the whole thing and then he wanted to comment about it. Well, that was very nice of him, and I was interested in finding out what his comments would be, and he did write something on the program post afterward. It was titled, it was a comment at my website on the program post. It was titled A Neo-JBS Plague. JBS stands for John Birch Society. But he didn't really talk much about it. Well, he may have talked a little bit about that. Yeah, you know, Metzger, what's his first name? Tom Metzger was a member of John Birch Society in his early years, and Bob is real friendly with Tom Metzger and was associated with him for quite a while, and I think that's why he brought up this kind of imagery, a John Birch Society plague. But he's wrote that the title is also, that this title is the title for his program which on Sunday, which was yesterday. He has a fourth position. Is the name of his show every Sunday morning. It's on Talk Shoe, or comes from Talk Shoe. And so I was thought I would listen to it, and I did. But I wrote to him today, and I told him, you know, that I was a little disappointed in his program because he didn't talk about all the things he said he would. And Bob is always so nice, you know, and he's always been nice to me. I don't know why sometimes I'm not as nice to him as he is to me, but he doesn't seem to take it personally. And he said that, no, his show is not as structured as mine, and he's kind of freewheeling, and a lot of it centers around his chat room guests and so on, and that's true. And so he gets off topic real easily and real quick. So a lot of this stuff didn't get discussed, but he said that he mentioned Hadding Scott's latest post at his blog, National Socialist Worldview, .blogspot.com, and he had mentioned that to me before, saying he thought that was good. And so he says good stuff about both my show and Hadding's blog, which really had nothing in common. I mean, they were different, but he just liked both of them. And he said the main area of contention is how folks view Slavs. In fact, this primary problem has plagued us since no later than the 19th century and will be brought up, he means on his show on Sunday. And said that was, thanks for your time, Bob. So that was, I thought, well, that's interesting. I want to see what he has to say. But like I said, he didn't say much. I'm going to go through what he did say, and I'm going to make some comments and so on. And just to, before I do that, I just want to point out that it seems to me, for what I know about Wolf Wall Street, is that his gift or his favorite thing or whatever you want to call it is to name things. He comes up with terms and slogans and catchy names. As a kind of way to, I think he feels that it gets people's mind in a way that better, maybe, or at least in a way that they don't reject so easily because it's not long-winded or anything. And one of his one of the things he's very well known for is the term kike Jew. And I don't know if that came from Tom Metzger originally or what, or not, because I don't really listen to Tom. I've listened to him a few times. But, you know, we all have the kind of things that we like, and I'm sure the ones that I don't care that much to listen to don't listen to me either. So that's fair. And he likes to use the term fourth position, which, you know, is not that clear, but you have to learn about it. And he has decided that he doesn't like white nationalism, and he calls it Pan-Aryanism. So that's why that's better than white nationalism, I don't know. But I could see why he would like that. And then he's come up with this word resist, which he uses on his emails and so on, and comments at the end, resist with a couple exclamation marks after it. And I think there's some more, but I couldn't think of any more of them at the time I was writing this. So anyway, Bob announced in this way that he was going to tackle the slop question, but as I said, he really didn't get very far with it. He pretty much repeated his main points, which I will cover here in a minute, and then didn't do any in-depth discussion about it. He likes to get phone calls, and he got a phone call, and it lasted for a long time. And then he started in again, and then he got another phone call. And he seems to be happy. Do I sound mean? I don't mean to sound mean. But he likes to get phone calls, and that's what he likes his show to be, talking with the callers and interacting with the chat room people, which when he doesn't have a call, he's checking to see what they're saying because he wants to and he did say that he likes to react to what other people are saying better than being the one to set out what he thinks is so. That's, of course, easier to do that. So there you go. I have to say that. So that was, and speaking of phone calls, I want to say, I always wonder if I have anybody listening. And I thought on Saturday that the weather was so nice that I wouldn't have many listeners. It turned out I had my second highest number of listeners since I started doing shows on Blog Talk than I have ever had. So it was really a lot of people. Whenever it's about white nationalism, people are really interested. And they might be also tonight because people are interested in when you talk about the Slavs and the Slav question, or Slavs versus or as separate from Western Europeans and so on, or Germans. So we'll see. And if I don't have as much material to go through tonight as I did on Saturday, and so I think I would, although I have quite a bit and I do want to do it, but I'm still welcome phone calls because of the nature of this topic. If they're not long-winded, you know, if you get to the point, I'd appreciate that. But I do welcome calls. I'm just going to say all the way through the show, as the number is 323-642-1206. Of course, it's better if you maybe in the second hour to make a call once you've heard what I have to say, and then you can comment or quibble about it or disagree with it or whatever. So once again, the number is 323-642-1206. All right. So Bob said that the real problem, he did say this, I listened to his Sunday program and I took down, and then I went back through it and I took down what I thought was important as far as I'm concerned with what he said. So this is not a word for word, but it's what it sounded like to me. He said the real problem is the question of Slavs. I mean, he seems to think that, but he didn't spend much time talking about it. He wants to get other people to talk about it. Okay, that's all right. That's legitimate. So here I am. Like I said, you know, okay, I'll talk about it. You want people to talk about it? And he said specifically he wanted me to talk about it. So I'm doing it. I'm not afraid to talk about it. He says it's a problem because it's divisive in white Aryan networks, he says. We really should resolve this question before we do anything else. And I just want to, he mentioned a couple of times that he was a friend of Daniel Sienkiewicz. I believe that's the way it sounds like he pronounces it. Daniel Sienkiewicz, known as Daniel S. over at Majority Rights and previously in other places. There's quite a lot of comments, too, to my show on Saturday. And I might have something to say about them later, but Daniel is involved, and Daniel and Bob are friends, but it has nothing to do with Bob, Daniel's comments. And then Bob goes on to say, Germans didn't accept the help of the Ukrainians. That was offered from Stephen Bandera, the nationalist leader, that he offered to fight with the Germans, and the Germans decided not to accept that, and he thinks that was a real bad mistake, and says maybe I'll concentrate on that, meaning yesterday on his program, but he didn't do that either. He said, though, quote, this is the quote, if Hitler had ever been swayed from his anti-Slav view, they would have won World War II within a year or two. And, I'm not so sure. A lot of people are sure about that. A whole lot of people make that statement with no problem. They think that's it. You know, that was a big mistake Hitler made. In fact, that woman named Denise called Bob, and during that call, in fact, maybe that's where that quote came from. And she said, oh, yes, she agreed. And just to say, because I wrote to Bob today, and I wanted to know what his ethnicity was. And it was what I expected it to be. It was what I would have thought. He told me he was half English, or British, and half German, or English, maybe he said, and half German. No Slav. He's not Slavic. I didn't think he was. He didn't appear. I've never met him. I don't know what he looks like. But he didn't. He's never come across that way to me. And I'll say more about that in a little bit. He talked about Tom Metzger a little bit on his show, and relating to how Tom Metzger became a pan-Aryanist when he discovered that the Slavic people were all white. I don't know what he knew. Maybe he didn't know anything about it. This was in the early time, you know, of his growth. And what they mean then is that white skin, all white people, people are white as long as they have white skin, and they all had white skin, so he considered that, we're all white, we're all equally white. And then after that, Bob made the statement straight out, I think Carolyn Yeager should resolve this question herself. Well, I'm not going to be able to resolve this question. It's not mine to resolve, but I will. I'm willing to say what I think about it. And actually, I have before, but maybe I'll be a little more blunt tonight. Now he says that because he knows that I'm sure he knows that I've been critical of pan-Aryanism. And even of white nationalism, saying that all white people are not equal or not the same, and we can't really come up with something that's going to include all of us in one big group, or certainly if you call it nationalism, we're not a nation, but Bob gets around that by calling it pan-Aryanism. So we would be, all members of a pro-Aryan or protecting the Aryans and so on organization. Well, it all sounds good in theory. I mean, it certainly does. So Bob then also made the comment, the Slav question is the reason we lost World War II for us, or the failure to, the failure of dealing with the Slavs properly. I've got that word stuck in there. I'm not sure. He says that's the reason we lost World War II. It really is. It was over. A done deal. There were millions of Ukrainians wanting to fight, but Hitler didn't see this. Well, Hitler did see it. He certainly saw it. But I don't know if Hitler didn't see this comes from that exactly, because he was then saying that Hitler didn't travel enough. You know, I've heard that a lot. A lot of people bring that up, people who are critical of Hitler, and they blame his so-called blind spots on the fact that he didn't travel. And so Bob picks that up and says, Hitler didn't travel enough. He didn't see how blonde these people were. Well, of course he knew they were blonde. And that's where I think he was saying that Hitler didn't see this. I'm not sure what went where. But Hitler didn't see how these people were the same as us. But of course he did. He did know. And he lived in Vienna for several years, the center of a multicultural German Slav empire. And he saw and interacted with plenty of Slavs. And he didn't like the Slavs. Not that he didn't know Slavs that he did like. Not that he didn't, find individuals all right. But he was very much a Germanist. And he didn't like the mixed effect of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the most active Slavs in Austria were in Vienna, which was the capital of the whole thing, were the Czechs. They were the majority of the minority, and they were very politically active and so on, and vocal, and they always spoke Czech, and he didn't like that. And of course he wrote in Mein Kampf about going to the parliament, that beautiful parliament building in Vienna, and thinking he was going to just see government in action. He was in awe of the whole place, and what he saw taking place on the floor there shocked him. And he thought it was just terrible because these people were talking, get up and give speeches in their own language, not just the Czechs, but others. And they would speak in their own language. And nobody else knew, could understand it, so they didn't pay any attention, didn't listen. And they were ignoring it or doing other things, leaving the room or whatever. And this was going on, and he saw that it was pointless what was going on. And he went back again and again and again, and he had a terrible impression of the whole thing. Now, Bob says about the Slavic people, they're white. But I think that Hitler would say, yes, but they're not German. Because Hitler was interested in the Germans and helping the Germans and lifting the Germans up, and he thought that this was the Slavs were not up to the level of the Germans and brought the whole thing down. That's just in a general view. So I think that there's a lot of things that just Bob here says about Hitler that can't be defended, and maybe that's why he doesn't want to actually go into any of them in any detail. So he also disagreed with me that on the Suvorov line, which but this actually has nothing to do with the topic of today or what I was on Saturday or what he was on Sunday. So, but he just brought that in for some reason from the past that he doesn't go along with Suvorov, which is about the how prepared the Russians, the Stalin and the Soviet Union was for Hitler's attack, Germany's attack. Of course, they were very, they weren't prepared for the attack, but they were prepared to attack themselves. But Bob says to attack Germany and Europe themselves, but Bob says that he disagrees with that. He follows some other line of thinking, but I don't know what that is. That could be a topic for another time. And I have talked about about this issue several times in the last, 4 years that I've been doing radio, but there's always room for talking about it some more from a different angle. Bob was kind enough to recommend my show a few times, saying it was an interesting one and people should listen to it. Some people said they didn't like listening to me. Some people in his chat room, he said, oh, well, okay, I can understand that. But anyway, after 15 minutes, he's run out of things to say about the Slavs, and then he's going into a few other things, and then he gets a phone call. So, but at the end, he got his second call from Alex, who is a Serbian, is a Serb, and is a regular caller to Bob's show, and they seem to be friends. And that was just chit-chat, too, nothing much substantial. He could have asked him about the Slav issue when they started out in the call, but he didn't. And he let Alex talk about whatever he wanted. And, of course, here's another thing. Alex said, I just came in and I saw your show was going on, so I thought I'd give you a call. Then I have no place to criticize how Bob runs his show or what his callers do. But I can't resist saying that he doesn't know what the show was about, but he thinks he'll just call up and chat. And that is kind of, Bob welcomes things like that. He doesn't care. See, that wouldn't work with me, but he doesn't care. He's happy to get distracted and talk to people, especially people he likes, like Alex, about anything at any time, just stop what else he was doing, because he doesn't really have a plan for his show. So as Alex was saying goodbye, Bob says, think about the Slav issue, because I think it is very key that the Slav question in the white struggle must be resolved effectively so that it doesn't become such an impediment to progress. Now, that's an exact quote from Bob. Think about the Slav issue, because I think it's very key that the Slav question in the white struggle must be resolved effectively so that it doesn't become such an impediment to progress. Well, if he thinks that, I think he should work on it. I think he should bring it up and get serious about it. Well, Alex responds that, oh, yes, I see what I know. He says he said that the difficulty we have is the way the Poles and the Russians hate each other, and also the way the Croats hate and the Serbs hate each other. So Alex is thinking, that tells me that Alex is thinking in terms of Pan-Slavism, that the Slavic problem is that the Slavs are not united, that they're angry, they, are opposed to one another on nationalistic levels. And Bob recognizes that, but Bob is a diplomat, if he's anything. He's always diplomatic, and he never, he's always sensitive to people. He doesn't say anything to offend them. And he says, yes, that's true, but he says, think about also from the aspect of Slav, non-Slav, white people. That's a sub-problem. And says something like that. And so what Alex said was the main problem, but this is a sub-problem. Well, he could put it that way, but I think Bob actually sees this as the main problem. The Slav, non-Slav differences, that's what Bob sees as the main problem. So that was the end of that show. Sorry, Bob. I'm sure you don't mind. You're not offended at all, I don't suppose. And so, you know, to give my view, I have some general points here that are not going to make me popular, and they're just just general statements that I'm not really prepared to go into too much detail on tonight, but some of this might come up in some of the things I'm going to be looking at. One is that, speaking of Hitler not using the Slavs in his fight against the Soviets, I would say the Slavs are unmanageable. And a lot of people he did help to put into the field, and a lot of people that fought for the Germans, there were problems with them. It wasn't like dealing with his own soldiers, his own German soldiers, who were trained in a certain way, and they had a oath of loyalty. I mean, an oath of loyalty to the Führer and things like that. No, you know, you're dealing with something very different, and it can really become more of a problem than a help. And that was the reason, in my opinion. But I can't back that up right at the moment because I haven't done the particular research on it for tonight. But going along with that, the Slavs would be and were and wanted to fight for their own objectives. These were nationalists in these countries, and they wanted to fight. They said, "Oh, great, the Germans are here. You know, we're ready to fight the same enemy you're fighting." And they were, but they were fighting for their own objectives, particularly Stephen Bandera, for a nationalist Ukraine, and that was not necessarily in the interests of Hitler and his plans. And so, they would. Interview, they'd talk to these people, and they would, you know, come to their decisions, and they just came to their decision that this was going to be a problem. And they didn't want these problems, and they hadn't been losing yet, so they weren't sure they needed them. What they wanted was their own very well trained soldiers, and they had millions of them there, and they thought they were prepared. So they didn't want to get involved in all of that. Now, point three, the Slavs, this is separate from what I've been saying, and with separate from Hitler, but Slavs insist on political correctness within white nationalism, or as Bob calls it, pan-Aryanism, or even in the European Union, you know, and I don't think that was political correctness is what I mean by you know, we're all equal, and we have equal standing with everyone else. And I don't think that that Slavs were ready to have equal standing with Western Europeans. And four, Russians are not my favorite nation. Russia is not my favorite nation, and neither is Serbia. And this is something I'm going to bring up real quickly here, pretty soon. Serbia is, and Russia have always been close, and Serbia is pretty much tied to Russia, always is on Russia's side. And I think that, I don't think much good comes out of either one of these countries. And I'm going to get really, you know, I mean, I realize I'm making enemies here, and that. Now I think about Lana Loktev, who's And not just because I was on, but I met her by being on her show. She's a lovely person. Lovely. She's 100% genetically Russian. But her grandparents left there. I think they were well-to-do, fairly well-to-do people. They had to leave a property. I don't know that they were super wealthy or anything, but they had to leave whatever they had behind to get out of there, get away from the Bolsheviks. And they went to Sweden, and her parents were born in Sweden, and of course she was too. So she's quite westernized. That doesn't mean, I think Russian women are the best. I think Russian women are really very, very good. But Russia as a nation, I think is always been a problem for Europe. And that's just, I'm not an expert on that, but that's just a feeling that I have and my opinion at the moment, for now. And I don't care for Serbians. Serbians, I used to think I really liked Serbian Serbs, and I thought Serbs are great, nationalistic people, great fighters, and I was very, very up and big on Serbs. But in all of my experience online with Serbs, it's always led to big problem, and they're hard to get along with. Unless you're very positive toward them. They don't take criticism. They're very touchy. And so I have a different opinion now. I see Serbs and Croats very, very differently. So let me just go on. I'm being very frank here. I looked up just a little bit of information about the Slavs. Slavs speak the Indo-European Slavic languages and share, to varying degrees, certain cultural traits and historical backgrounds. Because, it's like, well, what makes a Slav, and why are Slavs different from Germanics and the Latin people and the people of Western Europe? Why should they be different? We're all white. Here's the thing. We don't look so very different. So are we different or are we not different? Now, I'm saying that we're different. We are different. And so this is where I'm coming from here. So it says, now I wanted to know what all the Slavic countries were. And to repeat so that you're clear too, they're classified into West Slavic, East Slavic, and South Slavic. There's a lot of Slavs. The area covered by Slavs is much bigger than the area of Western Europe. Particularly because of Russia having. But this is only taking in the western part of Russia, not taking in the entire landmass there. But it's still very, very, very large and lots of people. And the West Slavs make up Poles, Czechs, and Slovaks, Slovakia, Poland and Czechoslovakia, that's West. East Slavs are Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians, or maybe it's Belarusians, Rusins, I don't know, Ukrainians, Russians, White Russians, and Ukrainians, and South Slavs are the Bosniaks, the Serbs, the Croats, the Bulgarians, the Macedonians, the Montenegrins, and the Slovenes. Well, they have all these separate little countries now, what used to be Yugoslavia. So, pretty much. Now, the Croats, I want to say, have many, many of them anyway, deny that they're Slavic, even though they speak a Slavic language. They say that they're from... They're directly descended from the original European population of the region that's always lived there for, way back, known by names like the Illyrians and their forebears. So the Slavs came in later, and they say that they're these original people. And they seem to want to separate themselves from being Slavic to some degree anyway. And they're a Roman Catholic rather than Orthodox. This may be what they write about themselves. They say they're noted for their cultural diversity, which has been influenced by a number of other neighboring cultures throughout the ages, and the strongest influences on them came from Central Europe and the Mediterranean, they say, and so on. All right. Now I'm going to go on to an email that I got today from a listener about the Saturday show. And I thought it was pretty good. So it's not that I agree with everything. He's quoting Spengler here, and I don't know that I'm a Spengler fan or follower at all. But I'm not. I've never studied Spengler that much. But from what I've heard, I might not be a Spenglerian. But he seems to be. But still, I want to read this. I think it's interesting. And he says, seems to me that this is another example of the problem of white nationalism. Not only does the latter, white nationalism, not account for national traditions, but are we now entering the realm of what is the basis definition of a civilization in terms of the moving spirit nature of a people? That is, he says, we're going... white nationalism is moving toward being too broad of a, that's the way I take this, too broad of an umbrella and wanting to claim too much. Anyway, that might not be what he thinks he meant. He says, I bring attention to Spengler's definition, which I believe is key. A people, in terms of a civilization, can only be defined not by logic, but by spirit, nature, which means what? Spengler used the Kantian, of the philosopher Kant, the Kantian categories of space and time, but not in the abstract universalist way of Kant, the prime symbol, that is, in quotes, the prime symbol, as he refers to it, as Spengler refers to it, for the West, or European whites, to use your terms, is the concept of the infinite. That is no abstraction or mysticism, but something expressed in the art and architecture of a people. For the West, the Gothic cathedral reaching for the heavens, the primacy of music in its highest expression with its ethereal quality, as opposed to the prime form of ancient Greece and Rome, the statuary. Along with the latter's should be inability to conceive of the mathematical concept of zero. So he is saying here that the Western European is personified in Gothic architecture and the primacy of music, and the other is more physical. In statuary, and they also didn't have the concept of zero. So he says, hence, white though they were, were they really white? He's thinking of white as having a more something of a spiritual quality, and that's been a big debate. I've been on the other side of that, but what he says here I think is interesting, that they're white skinned, but are they white do they have the same spirit? I wouldn't say they're not white in spirit, but I would say that the spirit nature of the two groups is somewhat different. And he points it out in this way. He says, for Slavs as Russians, and probably those to the West, they are not white as the movement would define it. One can look at their churches and onion domes to see that there's a different spirit guiding them, which is why they have not attained the same level as West Europeans in standards of living. And I dare say one gets a different feeling from them as opposed to a Frenchman, German, or Swede. Well, I thought this last sentence was the was the best one for me, because I agree with this. I think you get a feeling from people that you know, and for me, when it's the best is when it's a German, and I am German. So when you're meeting or speaking with dealing with the German, you feel very comfortable. You feel like you're at home with someone you know, and you understand them, and you know all of that. Anybody who's traveled to and dealt with people of other races in their culture knows that feeling, that when the difference between dealing with these people, as nice as they may be and as pleasant as it might be, is not as big, is very different from when you are speaking with somebody from home, you know, from your own land. It just it's such a different feeling. And so beyond German, if it's just someone who's Western European, French, Swede, or, you know, American for me, like that, it's it feels differently. Even here in the United States, if I'm speaking with someone whose ancestry is Western European, it's different than if I am talking with someone whose ancestry is Slavic. Generally, it would be, although I should be careful with that, because I just mentioned Lana Lochteff, and talking with her, I wouldn't know where, you know, if she's any different from me. So, and I don't think she is. So, but one has to, but sometimes it might just be the accent that you're hearing that feels different to you. I'm just putting this forth. You see, I could be wrong. I certainly could be criticized, and I could be seen as narrow-minded and so on. And here's the problem, that as dealing with the problems of our shrinking white race, it's not, you know, how can we want to make divisions among us? That's the whole reason for all this. That we don't want divisions. We want us all to join together and work together. But what I say is that I don't think we can work together effectively. Now, this is what I'd say to Bob, you know, that we can't work together effectively, as effectively as we need to, in that way, that there might be reasons to distinguish among ourselves, still be friendly and work together, but not think that you know, that that we can all do the same things, or we can just mix and match. I don't think we should intermarry either. So that's something that I have, which is different from many other people. But I'm going to go on. I've gotten this far. I'm going to continue here. I want to read something by Paul Goble, or spelled G-O-B-L-E. He has a blog that is called Window on Eurasia, and he says that, all right, I've looked him up, and he is, he's been involved in a lot of nationalist, maybe, you know, what we would, on the wrong side of white nationalism, you might say. And he's an expert on Russia. He's obviously, I don't know how obviously. He's not that fond of Putin and what Putin is doing. But what's interesting about his posts is that he translates from a lot of Russian writers and press things in Russian newspapers and so on. He obviously knows Russian, and he puts it in a very concise way that's easy to read. And someone who is pro-Russian introduced me to these, kept sending them to me, and I'd go and look and read it. And I finally decided I liked this, what this guy was writing. Finally, I liked some of it. I don't really know where people would stand on him, but I just saw this one that he put on there today, and I thought it was very pertinent to today's program. And it's titled, Did the Third Rome Create the First One? Some Russians Think So. And this is about Russians inventing and making up lies about their history and what for the people to believe about Russia and Russia's history and so on, which he says not him, but the person he's quoting here, the person he's translating from, says are not true. And this reminded me of a great article online that I came upon 5-6 years ago at least, about how the Poles have reinvented history in relation to the Germans. It's written by a German, but it's very very detailed, and I'm sure it's still there. But I couldn't find it. I didn't have the right keywords to come upon it. It didn't come up for me, and I went to the scriptorium at Wintersonnenwende because I thought that that's where I found it. But I went through all that, and I didn't see that there. So somebody might know what I'm talking about. I hope I will find. I used to have a link to. I've talked about it way, but it was such a long time ago. But anyway, this is has some similarity in that it's doing the same thing, but not in as much detail about the Russians. So you know, I think that this is not far-fetched at all. So I'll go ahead and read it. It's dated October 6th. The gold standard of Stalin-era claims that Russians had been responsible for everything positive in the world, this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, was that Popov invented baseball, unquote. But now under Vladimir Putin, some Russian writers, one hesitates to call them scholars, have surpassed that with claims about the role of Russia before it even existed in founding the first Rome. In a commentary on Oberzhervatel, some Russian site, yesterday, Oleg Panofilov, who ran the Moscow Center for Extreme Journalism between 2000 and 2010, but now is a professor at Ilya State University in Tbilisi, assembles some of the more outrageous claims Russian writers are now making. But what is more important, he points to the role of the Russian government in promoting such claims and the willingness of an increasing number of Russians to accept even the most outlandish, apparently because these claims appear to have the imprimatur of the Kremlin and the Russian establishment more generally. In other words, the Russian people really do tend to believe what their government tells them. A few days ago, Panfilov writes, he viewed a video in which Svetlana Zarnakova, a Russian ethnographer, suggested that the British had Russian origins. And he discovered that one Andriy Tyunyaev, the president of the Moscow Academy of Fundamental Sciences, has asserted that the ancient Rus, were Indo-Europeans who lived 4,000 to 1,000 centuries before our era. Tyunyaev's institution also employs a certain Valery Chudinov, who heads its Institute of Ancient Slavic and Ancient Eurasian Civilization. According to him, the Caucasus in antiquity was entirely populated by Russian mountaineers. He even explains the origin of the name Gruzia by suggesting it came from Rus, even though the Georgians call it Sakartvelo. And that has an exclamation point after it. So obviously, since I don't know any of this myself, but that is rather outrageous to say that. But Chudinov's discoveries are not limited to the Caucasus, Panfilov points out. According to the institute director, the Etruscans were Slavs from Smolensk, who then not only founded Rome, but were its first residents. Thus, representatives of the Third Rome somehow ahistorically founded the first one. Such absurdities would only be amusing were it not for one thing. The authors of these remarkable ideas are receiving grants from the Russian Ministry of Education and Science, and some of them teach in the Russian State University of Tourism and Service, or other government-funded institutions. Interesting that the government funds and a University of Tourism and Service, so I guess there are plenty of people employed in that who can run tours and carry out other services for tourism to when people come to Russia. Tyunyev, who enjoys that support, even as the Kremlin is cutting back on scholars at the Academy of Sciences, has even offered another discovery, Panfilov says. He reports that aliens landed in the area that became Moscow and intermarried with the local earthly population to produce the Rus, R-U-S. Clearly, Panfilov says, the authorities need pseudo-historians who will help with their propaganda to produce patriots absolutely convinced that the Russians are a great nation and even that Jesus was a Russian. Otherwise, how can one explain the fact that the Russian government is handing money to these people and disseminating their views? Panfilov says that he has long been convinced that precisely in Russia are concentrated all the lies of the planet. It has been that way for a very long time, he suggests. In the 18th century, Russian historian Nikolai Karamzin said that Russia was characterized by the fact that almost everyone steals. And Panfilov adds, theft without lying doesn't happen. This was an 18th century Russian historian who said that one thing that characterized Russia was that almost everyone there steals. Well, we know, and I've said this before, that Russia is listed as one of the most corrupt nations in the world, and all the Slavic nations are pretty darn corrupt as far as this kind of thing, where government people go in there in order to get everything they can. And the idea of serving good in good government in the way that Germany had it and still has it, I think, although it's taken over, you know, the United States runs Germany. Germany's not what it is. It's not for the German people anymore. But when it was, the Germans were known to be excellent, honest bureaucrats. And I'll just throw in right here the fact that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was run by Germans. They were the bureaucracy. They were I had another word for that, but can't think of it right now. And they did a good job. And it's also true that in Russia, the Russians, Russia had most of the Russian czars and monarchs and so on were mostly German, and they got marriage partners for their princes and so on from Europe, and mostly from Germany, but also sometimes Italy, you know, Italian princess, or a Swedish, a duchess or something, you know, some kind of royal links, and also England, and the the monarchies of Russia, Germany, and England were all interrelated. We're all related to one another. And what the main ethnicity that related them was German. So, and the Germans were the bureaucrats of the Tsars. They ran Russia and kept it, you know, functioning. And why is that? Why would that be so? Obviously, because the Russians couldn't do it. The Russian people didn't have that ability, didn't have that talent, and they did tend to be thieves. And that's the nature of the ordinary, common, un-Russian, far more than what you find in Western Europe, and particularly in Northwestern Europe. So now, going on here with this article, the Georgia-based scholar recalls that when he visited the Netherlands for the first time, his host took him to see where Peter the Great had lived and told him that the Russian flag had originated from the Dutch one. Panfilov says that was all fine, but he asked his host why they had not explained to Peter the Great, that a normal country can only be a small one like yours. Now, why is this? The Russian flag, why they had not explained to him that a normal country can only be a small one like yours. Don't ask me to understand that. 6 years ago, when Russia invaded and occupied part of Georgia, or maybe this is part of it. Here it is. 6 years ago, when Russia invaded and occupied part of Georgia, Panfilov continues, a journalist asked a Russian officer why they had come. All Georgia laughed about this answer. The Russian commander reportedly said, "You are Muslims, and there are 40 million of you," a reflection of the efforts of Russian propagandists and pseudo-historians. In quote marks, this is what this Russian commander said, and Panfilov says, over the course of almost the last 100 years, a completely new type of Soviet and then Russian man, educated by censorship and propaganda to believe in stories and invented histories, has appeared. Such people are prepared to accept the notion put out in one biography of Putin that he descends from nobility, the Rurikides, or even aliens who landed in Eurasia 50,000 years ago. I guess these are stories that are circulating. And it ends, and what if the Russians won't believe that? Well, says Panfilov, they will think up another story, which may have just as much basis in fact. Well, you can take that as a anti-Putin piece of work there, however you want to take it, but I believe that it's the idea of making up a lot of nonsense, and in this case being supported and funded by the government, by the Kremlin, is not out of line or unbelievable at all, and that it is going on, and that the Russian people are getting a very skewed picture of what's going on in the world today, and how much the West is against them, and what's going on in Ukraine and so on. But that's not the topic, so I need to move on. I want to talk, since I mentioned that I have a problem with the Serbians, I've been wanting to talk about the Serbian participation or blame in starting World War One. So I cannot find something that I had read a while back that is something that I read that was that described this, but I did find it in a couple of other places, and this is good enough. And you know what? It's 1 hour has gone by, so I'm going to just force myself to take a break here. And since I'm at this place and continue on with Serbia after we listen to one of my new pieces of music here. And I'm going to play Frank Reneke's The Girl with the Flag. And this is a duet, or it's both a woman's singer whose name I don't have, or right at the moment, or maybe I don't have it at all. And then Frank coming in. And some of my favorite listening music is when it's a male and a female voice together. And this is one of those. So I hope you enjoy it. It's only 3 minutes and 11 seconds long.
In Mai 45 in Hamburg etwa. Ich sing euch ein Lied von dem, was geschah. Es ist die Geschichte und viele sind gleich. Von dem Mädchen mit der Fahne vom Deutschen Reich. Das Mädel war 15, als der Feind im Reich stand. Doch ihr Herz gab nicht auf ihren Kampf für das Land. Und so nahm sie zur Hand in der bittersten Not die Fahne des Reiches, schwarz war heiß und rot.
Auf einem Motorrad ein Engländer kam. Und sah nun das Mädel mit der Fahne im Arm. Doch es durfte nicht sein, dass in seinem Bereich man die Fahne noch zeigte vom Deutschen Reich. Er lacht über sie, noch mahnend er schreit. Komm, gib mir die Fahne, sei brav und gescheit. Komm, gib mir die Fahne, hör auf mein Gebot. Hier zeigt niemand die Farben schwarz, weiß und rot.
Von der Fahne zu lassen, das singst du mich nicht. Er fährt wie mein Blut, so trotzig sie spricht. Noch trag ich ein Messer und das Leben ist gleich. Wenn ich sterbe, so fall ich für die Fahne vom Reich.
Er stieg auf sein Kratz mit bleichem Gesicht und fuhr seinen Weg, als noch leise er spricht. Warum geht nur ein Kind noch jetzt in den Tod? Warum nur dieses Opfer für Schwarz, Weiß und Rot?
Noch an dem Abend stand die Fahne dahin. Das bewaffnete Mädel kam ihm nicht aus dem Sinn. Ihr Leib war zerschossen, die Lippen ganz bleich. Sie stand noch am Abend für die Fahne vom Reich.
Das Opfer des Mädchens vergesst ihr es nie. Verliert nie den Stolz und kämpft wie sie, bis es endlich so weit, dass auch hier irgendwann die Zeichen des Reiches man zeigen kann. Die Zeichen des Reiches man zeigen kann.
And that was Frank Renica with the female vocalist. And that was a song, The Girl with the Flag. And I have the words to that, but I didn't want to go hunt them down because I'm a little concerned that I might not have the best connection here and I don't want to take any chances with it. So, but another time I'll read the words to that in English. So let's go on now to talk a little bit about the Serbian role in starting World War One, and I have a couple of comments here from someone on the historyforum.com. I didn't put his name down as one of those screen names, but this is what he wrote. And the first one, he said something in response to someone else, and then a couple of people responded, and then he said something more. But I only have his responses here. And it is, he said, Austria knew of the involvement of Sikanovic and Tankosic, that period, those two men who were involved in the assassination of the Archduke, Ferdinand, the Austrian Archduke. And so he says they had traced, that is, Austria had traced the assassins' weapons to a Serb government arsenal, and Austria had every right to expect Serbia to undertake an internal investigation on that account, but Serbia refused. The Austrian and Serbian ambassadors almost came to blows because of Serbia's cavalier attitude. Serbia laughed in Austria's face by mobilizing hours before replying. Before they even replied, they mobilized their forces. This sounds a little familiar with some other places and times and beginnings of wars. German support of Austria was far more justified than Russia's support of Serbia. And yes, you're right, Serbia had already promised to behave in 1909 in writing. Let me just add here that, you know, Serbia, in my, as I can see it, has always been a rather a hotbed of revolution and criminals and underground stuff, and a lot of it is maybe with the help of a Russian agents, intelligence agents, Russia uses Serbia, and Serbia gets help from Russia, so it's a relationship that seems they think works for both of them. But then some people said some things, and of course this can be argued, and I'm not having anybody here to argue this, which is I don't particularly want to do that tonight because I don't have time. But something could be, this, you know, well, if Alex and Bob and Wolf Wall Street do a program together on some of this, they can talk about it then. I'd be interested in what they would say. Their perspective. Anyway, his second comment was, I suspect you need to read a book or two, to somebody who was saying something to him. He said, in the first place, Germany and Austria had a formal alliance while no alliance of any sort existed between Russia and Serbia. Second, the Russian Tsar was Nicholas II, not Alexander. Third, Russia was in part responsible for backing Greater Serbia agitation. Right. And finally, Austria was intent upon a purely local dispute with Serbia, while Russian intervention meant a European war. Well, from here, I'm going to go on to Wikipedia on their page, Russia-Serbia Relations. And this is what I found there in this certain part. And I'm going to read this. It's two paragraphs. One of the factors that led to the beginning of the First World War were close bilateral relations between the Kingdom of Serbia and the Russian Empire. Even several years before a diplomatic crash between European powers was inevitable, Russia openly sought political and religious influence in Serbia. In May 1914, well, that's the year the war started, but before that, earlier in that year, Serbian politics were polarized between two factions, one headed by the Prime Minister Nikola Pašić and the other by the radical nationalist chief of military intelligence, Colonel Dragutin Dimitrijević, known by his code name APIS, APIS. And that's well, I mean, that's very factual. I've read that before. In that month, the month of May 1914, due to Colonel Dimitrijević's intrigues, this is the radical nationalist, King Peter dismissed Pašić's government. That's the prime minister of the government they have. But the Russian minister in Belgrade intervened to have Pašić's government restored. So the Russians wanted to keep Pašić in there. Pašić, though he often talked tough in public, knew that Serbia was near bankrupt and having suffered heavy casualties in the Balkan Wars and the suppression of a December 1913 Albanian revolt in Kosovo, needed peace. That is, Serbia needed peace. Since Russia also favored peace in the Balkans, from the Russian viewpoint, it was desirable to keep Pašić in power. However, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand gave Austria-Hungary the excuse it needed But see, now this is propaganda. I'm not even going to read this sentence. Well, I guess I better. But this is propaganda. This, everything before this has been sourced in something. It's the same one book, and the first one was something different, but is sourced. But this sentence is not sourced, and this is something that was added by these communists, you know, and Russians, and nobody was able to change it or remove it. Or corrected. It says, however, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand gave Austria-Hungary the excuse it needed to declare war on Serbia. They didn't want to declare war on Serbia. They had no intention of doing that. And so Russia's efforts to maintain peace via government manipulation were futile. So Russia was trying to maintain peace. Yeah, sure. Next paragraph, after the first war ended, the Russian Civil War ensued, in which a small number of mercenaries from Yugoslavia fought for both the Russian whites and the Bolsheviks. After the war ended, in 1922, relations between the Kingdom of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union dwindled up until the build-up to World War II, as the latter had a newly formed communist government, whereas Yugoslavia remained a monarchy until 1941. Well, I don't know what that is adding there, but just the connection between the two countries, that Russia uses Serbia when it needs it, and it's always been there. And there's that. They're great friends, and all the Serbians today are all on the side of Russia in this Ukraine thing and put out a lot of nonsense, if you ask me. And talk about where the Jews are and so on all the time. I don't trust these two countries, and I don't feel that they represent what I would think of in the way of Western or European values. So I'm going to say another thing here that comes from a book by A.P. Laurie, who is an Englishman, and Katana has been putting that on his blog in parts, and he will finish it. This is the title of it is The Case for Germany, and it was written and came out in 1939. And in this little part here, it refers to the Czechs. So, you know, I'm talking here about different Slavic groups and their attitudes toward Germany and Austria the West in general. And he writes here, Hitler had pledged himself in his speech on March 7th, 1936, that all adjustments of territory between Germany and other nations should, whoops, here's a phone call. All right, I said I'd take it, so I better take it. Hi. Hi there.
Yeah, hi.
How are you, Carolyn? This is Marcus.
Well, hi, Marcus. Nice of you to call.
Hi. Yeah. I thought I'd give you a call because nobody else dares.
Well, no, there isn't, although I still got quite a bit of stuff to cover. So I always have more than I think I do. But it's there's still plenty of time, so go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the Slavic question is a difficult question, but if we look at Jewish resources, they always speak about the German spirit versus the Jewish spirit. So from that perspective, they know what's going on, and if we look back into history, the Caliphate was stopped by the West Francians, the Turkish invasion was stopped in front of Vienna. Countries, the Slavic countries like Serbia or Bulgaria and so on, they are always going to be in the middle of this conflict. Either Turkish influence or German influence. So it's a matter of choice. If we want to be an independent Europe, we have to make an order that serves us all, more or less, and it's hard that everybody is gonna be a big player in this.
Right. Everybody. Yeah. Right. Of course, we agree on that, but other people might not. Let me ask you, Marcus. As my sound on this program, as you've been listening to it, has it been okay, or does it get a little garbly sounding at times?
No, the sound is okay. It cut out a few times for a few seconds. I remember when you said something about Lana, that it cut out for a second. But only a few seconds. Maybe it was on my side.
Well, that's
my
Wi-Fi
talk. Didn't work.
Yeah, it has that. But you were sounding just a little bit bubbly when you were talking, but that might be my sound just to me. So I can, there's some, all this stuff. So, but I guess we're okay. So,
I hope you can understand what I'm saying in general.
Well, I understand. I didn't know about the other people.
what I'm saying is the Slavic people, whoever they are, they're nationalists, and that's all fine, and they should keep their customs and so forth and their heritage, but to fight off the enemies. And it's not only one. I mean, we have one enemy, and then we have the Turkic people who come in, and the Arabics, and so on. We need to make an order that works. And the ego comes in the way, I believe.
Yeah, and this little nationalisms of little countries that feel that they've not been given enough importance, or feel like they haven't been treated right, or have this grievance and that grievance, and that's true. They do get this way. I think the Slavic countries get this way more than the others. Now, I wouldn't include Russia being so big and more important all along, but now Putin is, this is going on now in Russia with Putin, and the whole Russians are being told that they're being picked on by the West, and they're being treated very badly and so on. And they believe so that's the same thing.
Yeah, in today's world, when we talk about the West, it's Americanism.
That's right. America is a new hated place. There's so much hate for America now. Then I'm starting to feel feel a little more not sympathetic, but like, well, let's not overdo it with how terrible America is. It is true that the Jews have been running it, but still they seem to want to destroy it, and what's going to take, I don't know, what's going to take the place. I can't see turning to the East and abandoning the West. See, that's what it looks like to me, and I can't go along with that. I'm much too Western.
Yeah. So my thing is that the West and East, Europeans or Western Europeans are in the middle. They need a Western nor Eastern. And that is totally ignored nowadays. You can only be on the American side or on the Russian side. But since the Axis power or powers were eliminated, it was absorbed into the West, Italy.
Yeah,
Germany.
You're right, and it's Anglo-American. It's America really calls the shots, but Britain is Britain doesn't know where to go. You know, they want to join with Europe, but they don't really feel that loyal to the continent, and they're totally, you know, they're dominated by the Jews too, more, you know, totally. So, well, they're just Jewish. More and more, you know, there's this understanding of how the Jews are so intermarried into the British ruling class.
Yeah, that's another part, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's not true yet in continental Europe, not the way it is in Britain. But it could, I don't know if it could happen nowadays anymore. We don't have all those aristocrats, but I don't, yeah, there's no easy answers because if Germany was really Germany, then I could say we could get a plan going, but there it's not. So.
Yes, but we're talking about hypothetical things here and things that are rooted in the soul, because you know Germany is occupied, we know all that, but it's still a running country, and it still does pretty well, and so it's basically still the same. It's just Germany is not the beneficiary of its labor, so to speak. It doesn't have a say in what it's doing. But it's still a functioning country.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. That sounds good. That's what I'd like to think that myself.
Yeah, and the same is true basically for all Western European countries, be it Sweden, England, or Britain in total. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many people wanting to go in there, right? It has to function one way or the other. Otherwise, it wouldn't be attractive. And it wouldn't,
well, of course, you know, Western European nations are all very attractive to the Eastern Europeans. Very attractive. They haven't reached that, and I don't know that. I don't think they. Like you said, it goes to the soul. I don't think they're capable of creating that on their own. Well, Czechs do pretty well now, but nobody wants to go to Czech Republic, or maybe they don't let them in. I don't know. But, you know, if you're not Czech, you're not very welcome there. But they do well for their own. But not well enough because they're going out into Europe, too, just like the Poles do.
Yeah. It's true.
Sure.
So if we want to get rid of the EU, but still want to be in a European confederation, so to speak, we still have the same problem. How are we going to figure this out so it's beneficial for all? And it seems that... many, let's say, Poles or Ukrainians, and they like to go to Western European countries and be part of that society, and then you know send some money back home, or I can totally understand that from an individual position.
But that's like the Mexicans do in the United States.
In a long term, yes. Right. In a long term situation, it eats up the capital. It would be more beneficial if the Western European countries would stay what they are and have some more influence in the Eastern European countries to help them become more prosperous nations, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, see, but you can only help people so much. And I made that comparison to the Mexicans and Central Americans and so on, coming up into the United States and working and, you know, offering their labor and sending as much money as they possibly can back home. And that that's not a healthy situation at all.
No,
and
it's
this
not,
is what
but,
a lot
we
of
have
the,
a little, it's a little bit different in Europe because
yeah, it wouldn't
Mexico
be the same
is,
to the thing.
No, Mexicans are, for the most part, a different, totally different race.
Right.
And in Europe, we are one racial community.
But it's the same process going on. It's
yes,
the same
yes,
process going on, sending
yes.
the money back. And if, how is that?
Yes.
And again, how many, the West has already gone into the East and helped it out. Gee, back in time, and they're like resentful of it. The Germans were always called to come and do this and do that, and the Germans built all this stuff there and
yes.
and raised the standard of living. And then they get mad at the Germans and slaughter them and kick
yes.
them out and steal from
yep.
them. You know, and now why should these people who behave like this, and this is the way they behave, why should people like the Germans keep going and bailing them out? Right after the war, the poor Germans
yes.
finally got themselves together a little bit, and then they're helping out the Poles and sending money to Poland.
That was part of
exactly.
the Nuremberg thing. That's part of the whole Nuremberg thing, and it goes in that category. But let's put this all aside. If we could take power and we had our own countries, our own continent in our hands, we need to make an order. How and we can surely we can just separate and live more or less peacefully side by side. and yeah, I mean there will always be local wars. For a river, you know, or a city, it's, you know, that's not going to change. But it doesn't have to blow up to become world wars. Besides that, we can figure things out. And how are we going to do this?
Well,
and
you think it
my,
can be done without
my,
military power? Do people just agree on things and then leave it at that? Or does there have to be, doesn't there have to be always some military power to enforce the order? And if you don't want to do that, then you're going to have things don't just happen that well.
The question is, if we are a European community and we want more or less the standard, the Western standards all over Europe, is it that the eastern countries just take and don't give anything in return?
I don't know if they want
that. The Western countries, I don't know either. That's
because
that's
you know these people are very proud of their own selves and histories and so on. And they, I don't think you could say that they're all going to say, oh, yeah, we're going to live according to the Western standard. They're very busy right now attacking everything about the West. And they think it's decadent and what have you. And yet at the same time, they want the money. They're mixed up people. They're mixed up. You know, they want to be for, they want what you have, but they want to be against you. And that reminds me of every kind of racial minority there is. And they're in some sense, then they're the ones who cannot. I'm going to come out and say it. I know it's very, boy, I'm probably going to lose all kinds of few friends I still have. I'm going to lose a lot more of them.
In general, you're right. But the difference is that we are cousins. That's the difference.
Yeah.
And we need each other to protect Europe.
Well, that's the basis of the European Union, Marcus. That's what the European Union says it's doing. That's why it brings all these nations in.
Yeah, yeah.
And says we're going to help them.
What,
we've already done that. The European Union has helped every country that comes into it. It gives them in the beginning a whole bunch of help. and, you know, and then they're supposed to carry on from there. Well, they're not, they don't carry on from there very much. They keep wanting more help.
Yeah, that's true. But the European Union is not really. I'm thinking about what we would do. You know, the European Union.
But it would
Union
be the same principle. The same principle where the strong help the weak.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. The European Union is such a great idea, but in the end, it's only, you know, you cross the Mediterranean Sea. And land on an island in Italy, you know, some people from Africa, and then you can, you know, because of the European Union, you can directly go to Sweden instead of being stuck in Italy. That's what it comes down to in European Union under this foreign European Union. If we had our European Union, we could still really talk eye to eye and think. What's beneficial for all of us and what is not. So just replenishing empty state budgets of other countries to the detriment of Western countries would not be beneficial. So what would be? Or do we actually care in the West? We could also have different economies and still be an alliance. You see?
What I see, Marcus, is that we would, if people recognize themselves in terms of white or in terms of Aryanism or however you want to put it, then that's good, and we have ourselves allied along those lines. But at the same time, we have separate economies, and you rise or fall on your own darn boots, you know, on your own work.
Yeah.
And if you can't do it, you're not going to die. If your country is poorer than others, and if you don't look as, you know, you don't have all the big buildings. I mean, how much civilization has actually been created in, say, the Balkans, or, you know, it just hasn't been. And the civilization that was created in what was called West Slav, was most of it was built by Germans. So, I mean, you know, these people have not done this, but you have to leave them alone. They want to do their own thing, but they want to, as it was pointed out in a couple of the things I was reading before you called, that they will make up history. They will make up lies about what they've done and what's been done to them and so on. They do all this stuff.
Yes.
It's childish. But that's where they are,
That is true.
I don't think they're going to change. I think this is their nature, and it's going to stay.
We can
live with it and love them, and, you know, but go ahead.
But you can't just write them off because
writing them off. Well, I'm saying
like
that they...
It's like a family...
But in a family, you don't support your children forever. I mean, you know, everybody in the family does their own thing, and some get rich and some are poor. But you still all come together maybe on Thanksgiving or something, you know.
Exactly.
And then nobody cares.
So that's what I mean.
But they don't all have the same life. Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If Europe gets attacked by the Mongolian hordes or the Arabs or anyone, then it will always come down to the core, the big price. And that is always in Central Europe and Western Europe. The other, it's a fringe that has to be conquered in the Balkans, for example, to go into the middle of Europe or western of Europe. So the Balkan people, they have to realize this, that when European troops are basically on their soil, it's not that bad because we are basically one community against the Turks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there might be Austrian troops in Bosnia. And you can discuss how much power they have, and I understand that it's not so pleasant to have other people running the show there. But beyond that, we have a greater responsibility, and can't just say we don't want either, you know, because then we are only these small countries. And with Russia,
yeah.
Russia is a big country, but Russia is Kazakhstan and all these Mongolian and all these people. It's not that Russia is only Russians.
Right. When I was looking at a map of that I have in my files of Slavic Europe, and they only show the western part of Russia. That's what's considered Slavic Europe, and all the rest of Russia. I guess the other three-fifths or four-fifths or something of it is something else, you know.
Yeah.
That's such a huge place. I think it's too big. I don't think any country should be that big.
It's half of, even after the collapse of Soviet Union, it's still the biggest country in the world. It's half of Europe and half of Asia.
Yeah.
So think about that. And it's only how many people in Russia now? 150 million or 200 million? And
well, that's
the
thing.
That, yeah. And that compared to, let's say, Germany, for example, is 80, 90 million. If you add Austria and Switzerland, you have maybe 100 million people. And that's such a tiny space compared to what you know, and
then we come back to
Hitler's plan to make the euro the protection of Europe. You know, what is so bad about that?
Well, that's what I was just going to say, and when that brought to my mind what you're saying, that that Hitler's idea was to expand into these areas and make life better. Although these people wouldn't be able to kick you out. I mean, you know, they wouldn't have, I don't know how it was going to be. But, you know, he was going to bring the West further east, so to speak. And all these people act like, oh, they are just, you know, going to destroy us and take over our countries and so on. And yet, this is what gets me about the, the Slav, and you know, not all this area is Slav, the Slavic nations. Now, let's remember, the ones I like the best, oh, I shouldn't say that, I'm terrible, but the Baltic countries and Finland, they're not Slavic. And they do quite well. Poland is doing well, and Czech Republic does well, and Slovakia, where do they call themselves now? Slovakia or something? They do all right, I guess.
Yeah, we also, read about the Bohemian
Kingdom. But then you have
a
Hungary and Romania are not Slavic, and a few others down there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the Bohemian Kingdom, which was part of the first German Reich, or the Holy Roman Empire, and they're Czechs, and before Austria basically had the say in Bohemia, the Czechs had quite a bit of say in Bohemia and also in Austria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were always part of the German realm, more or less. They were in charge of their own affairs, or the Austrians were in charge there, but it was always a community, even though
they
are not.
And I don't know if it's genetic or if it's because of what you're just saying, that the Czechs seem to me to be the most German-like of the Slavic nations, but they so jealous and angry at Germany, you know, at Germans, that they are feeling competitive or something. So instead of just joining with the Germans. But, you know, there's interference. Heydrich would have gotten the Czechs to go to really join up with Germany. I think he would have. And that's why the English saw that and came in and had him assassinated and tried. And then what the Germans had to do to pay back for Heydrich's assassination, then that was used against them all along. And
yeah.
So this is the kind of interference that takes place when things could be going much better.
Yeah, I was also going to talk about, or basically repeating what I said in the comments already.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler wasn't, straight out anti-Slav. He criticized his own people. We know about what he said about the Saxons. We know about what he said about the Prussians or the Bavarians. And it's all true, you know.
And women.
He criticized
everybody.
You know, it's not offensive if you just speak the truth. I mean, it's the same when Americans say, well, the Northerners are like this or the Southerners are like that. It's just the way it is. It's good and bad, and just laugh it off. And he made assessment on the British. He praised them in one way, and he totally smashed them in another way. And it's all true. I mean, it's not bad. It's just the way it is.
It's very good.
So what I'm saying is, it's not that he didn't want to join with the Slavs because he hated the Slavs. He was allied with independent Slavic states, Slovakia, and Croatia, for example, Bulgaria, and maybe another country. And he was also allied with Poland during Pilsudski. And he was very proud of Polish nationalism, how it developed, how they regained their nationalism after 200 years or so of basically having no own country. And who was it giving back Polish sovereignty? Austria and Germany, not Russia, in 1916.
Right.
So it's not Polish or Germanic. I mean, what he said about America and Britain, is that, anti-Germanic, anti-German? Or is it just the truth?
Right.
You see?
Right.
And that's my whole point. And what I want to say about that he didn't allow generals of the Soviet army to become deserters, fighting for the enemy. That is ignoble, and it's not allowed under international law. So even if he was willing to accept their help, it's not legal. You see what I mean?
Okay,
you can accept an independent state. You can accept an alliance, but you cannot accept an army or a battalion you captured. They only can be neutralized. You cannot, force your own will, or even if it's good for you, you know, it's not the rule of law.
What about Wolf Wall Street? Saying that, and other people all agreeing with that, Hitler's greatest mistake was that he didn't make use of all those Ukrainians and then others, too. I don't know who the others were, but who didn't like the Russians and wanted to fight on their side, and he didn't make use of them. Do you think that's any kind of a valid argument?
We have to look at the rules of law. And the rules, or the rules of war, you know, and these rules are written down in the Hague Convention and also the Geneva Conventions. And under that rules, Ukraine was part of Soviet Union. Even if they were nationalistic, they were part of another state. So they were allowed to join the SS, but not you cannot abuse the national military of another country.
Well, these were just people who, you know, citizens of Ukraine. And you're right, it was part of Russia. But they never did like being ruled over by Russia. People seem to forget that. They think they're Russians. They didn't think they were part of
the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but I think it would be not a very good fighting force myself. I mean, you can't just take a rabble of people, and then you have to train them, you have to arm them, you have to put uniforms on them. It's all a lot of money and expense. And then if they don't fight well, what have you got? In fact, these kind of things turn out to be bigger problems. Then you have to bail them out because they get in trouble. I don't think.
That may be one part, but it's more that Germany followed the rules of war or warfare, and under that rule, you can only accept volunteers in the Waffen-SS, and Ukrainians certainly joined the Waffen-SS. Because that was a volunteer, basically paramilitary unit. It wasn't. So the Soviet Union was the state, and Ukraine was part of it, and their national army was neutralized by the Germans, and they were captured and put in, in the POW camps. And under the rules of law, you cannot abuse them and make them fight on your side, even if they want to. You see? So that's what the Allies, Germany did the same in France. They only neutralized the French military and had the right to expand their defense or offense lines within France. But they are not allowed to be the sovereign in France. That's not how it works under the Hague Convention. That's why the Allies totally ignored it, and wherever they went, to Romania or whatever, they forced them to declare war on Germany, even though they were only allowed to neutralize the military and then expand their defense or offense lines in. Following the rules of law.
Okay.
And he accepted independent Slavic states, and he allied with them, no problem. And he also accepted Slavic volunteers in the SS, no problem either. It's not that he didn't accept them because they were Slavs. He didn't accept the French military either. French Navy was just neutralized, so it isn't a harm for Germany anymore. But it wouldn't be a harm for Britain either. It's just not working anymore. And that's how it works under the rules of warfare. And the Allies, they didn't care about that.
I've got two calls here from you on my board. Did you lose the call and recall a second time?
No, Carolyn, that's me.
Oh, they're both the same phone number.
Well, you know what it is. It's Skype. He probably uses Skype.
Oh, I see. Okay, all righty. Well, then, hi, Bob. I thought it was another call, and I answered it.
I'm sorry. I came late. Let me just explain. I came late because there was another debut show tonight. And I didn't know that you were going to do this show. I went to go to your site before and forgot, and then they got involved with the other show, which was a new one.
Okay.
But anyway, I'll go through it later.
Well,
but I would like to correct one thing. I don't think I asked you to resolve the Slav question. I said it's a very important question, and I have a friend of mine.
You did. I've got it down. I quoted you exactly.
Maybe I did, but
Carolyn,
I misspoke if I did.
Resolve this.
Well, I'll have to go back and listen to that myself, because I must have misspoke if I said it that way. I meant it must be resolved. I must have misspoke.
Yeah.
But my point is that I've got both a Polish friend and a Serbian friend. Now, one's Orthodox and one's at least the other one is Roman Catholic based. I don't know if he's religious or not. But it's going to be very interesting. I've got a couple people there that I want to flesh this out because I think it's a very important question. And I haven't, like I said, I haven't heard the beginnings of your show, so I've got to go back and listen to it. But it's so important because you can see how divisive it can be. And if we can resolve this at least to a high degree and explain where the cracks and crevices are such that will not be able to wangle us, whether there's strong parts.
It's not Jews behind it, Bob.
It's
real differences in people. It's not differences that you can't, as Marcus is making such a good case for, that you can't work out and get along with, but you have to have some understandings. But to say that, you know, you just have to understand who's who and what's what the real history is. My big problem is that the history is always being distorted and denied. And that's, I think you can't get to the reality of things without accepting the real history. So that's what needs to be resolved first is the history. And
that's not
going to happen either.
It's got to happen. If not, it will just devolve into what I just said. It will leave cracks and crevices with which the Jews can go in and wangle differences and create left-right confrontations or something similar to that. That's what they do. You know, they're very good at it. So we have to head them off at the pass, so to speak, of course a little late, but we got to resolve this. We know that there's no equality any place in the world. Even among yourself, your left eye doesn't match your right as a 180. And basic elements are different as to time, space, and vector. There is no equality any place. So, you know, people know this down deep. They know this, but a lot of times they're given these false memes, these false paradigms to live within, and they just sort of go along to get along. And that's my point, though. You can see the Slav problem. I didn't hear the early show, but I do know that Adolf Hitler was anti-Slav, and I think one of the reasons was that
he wasn't anti-Slav, and Marcus has been talking about that. I think you're wrong about that when you say that. He didn't have a high opinion of Slavs. He thought Germans were more, I hate to use the word superior, because whenever you use that word, people go crazy. But he thought Germans were far more competent and he saw all the failings, what he considered of Slavs, but didn't make him anti-Slav. What do you say to that, Marcus?
Let me just say one thing.
Okay,
even if
go
that's
ahead.
The case, even if that's the case, then that has to be resolved in their minds, get beyond the ego question in their minds as well as our own, and maybe we'll find out some other things. We'll find out that maybe...
Well, I think there's a lot to find out, and I think you're probably not as well read and versed on history, Bob, because it's hard to be on all of this stuff, and I don't know when you came in on this, but it's real hard to catch up with it all. Go ahead.
Well, the only thing is that the reason I brought it up is I see it as one of the critical issues, because if we don't resolve this one, it'll just be, like I say, it will be an area of easy manipulation, and we've got to resolve these areas of easy manipulation. It, you know, we just have to get to a higher level and to
that's right. When on your show Sunday, when Denise called in, you talked about a variety of things, but at some point, you said something about Hitler being anti-Slavic. She said, "Oh, absolutely right. That's the reason. That's why he lost." And all these people just rolls off their tongue as though they know. You see, and they're just repeating what they've heard.
Well, that could be. I'd like to see a lot of proof on that, because I know when you say he had a low opinion, I just know what he did. I do know that the Ukrainians would have, many Ukrainians, because what happened to them, absolutely hated the Russians, and in particular the Jews. In fact, a lot of the atrocities, I'm pretty sure about this, that happened to Jews weren't done by the National Socialists. They were done by the Ukrainians, the locals.
That's right.
Because they just, you know, they wanted to, they were, but they didn't use them. And at least it was too late. And I heard a little bit of what Marcus said, that they weren't a legal entity. Well, that's – you just make them a legal entity. I mean, that's a matter of might makes right. You know, that's a matter of just willpower, triumph of the will. You just do that. No, they didn't use them, and they were there.
Well, I think there's other reasons. I was giving other reasons that they weren't going to be that effective. But you can't just send people out and say, okay, go after the enemy. You know, they're going to get in trouble. Look at the trouble that Germany had with Italy, even. They had to go and save them a couple of times. And it was a big, big problem. And everybody recognizes today that in some ways they would have been better off without them.
Well, Carolyn, though. The Carolyn, they would have been auxiliary troops. They would have been auxiliary troops. But
They had other auxiliary troops, and they didn't. Well, I shouldn't say it because lots of times they did well. It could have been done, but I don't know if the Germans had enough manpower to train and deal with all of that. You know, they didn't have endless numbers of people.
That's another thing. Vlasov had 200,000 ready to go.
Bandera
already had a certain amount. Now, it was smaller, obviously, because it was a guerrilla operation, but he must have had some thousands anyway. So there was a nucleus there to work around.
Marcus, do you know why they didn't want to use Vlasov's troops there? I don't know anything about it. I mean, I've seen it, but I don't know.
No, I don't know. I don't know of any quotes or such, but I know of the rules of law, just what I said, and also that there was a Ukrainian SS troop, just like there was a Belgian U.S. SS troop, but not the Belgian military wasn't used by the Germans.
Well, let me just stick in here real quick that what I've been reading in Table Talk, that you got to remember that Hitler is just talking with his own inner circle there, and he's expressing different feelings, but that's not necessarily, you know, official policy or everything, the total way he sees things. I don't know if you're listening to that, but I thought some people might think that that's what proves your friend Daniel thinks that proves. How do you pronounce that?
Sinkiewicz.
That proves that you know, that Hitler was so viciously anti-Slavic and just wanted to dominate.
Carolyn, this is something I want to resolve too. I mean, it's not like I'm not one-sided here. I'm trying to take a problem and resolve it as much as humanly possible. And it's going to take some time. I was just bringing up the problem the other day, and I misspoke if I said you had to solve it. I don't think this is anything that could be solved in a few hours. You know, this is something. That's why I want to go with my friend Alex from Serbia and Danny and talk to them and, you know, just get over the ego thing. And that's tough. You know, there's a lot of ego involved here too. And
sometimes it's not just ego. It's your kind of hard beliefs that you don't want to. You can't give up or something. You're not willing to give up. I don't know. You know, your point of view, and it can be a world view. You know, your world view is different.
No, look. Hitler also said things about the Swiss Germans. They're Germans, but he said something's wrong with them. You know, so is he anti-German now, or is he just observing the truth?
Who?
I don't know.
Daniel?
No, Hitler.
Know. Oh, Hitler.
Hitler spoke about the Swiss Germans.
He said there's something wrong with them as Germans. Okay.
Yeah. And
he
that
said
doesn't
a lot
mean
of
they're
things.
Bad people or whatever. It's just, you know, these are things, I don't know, if maybe Americans don't understand the European structures. I mean, that's what Hitler said about Roosevelt. You know, it's not like we all, you know, there's just one from Kentucky and the others from Texas. We are separate people. We are one race, maybe, or racial related, but it's not like we are this one state and then there's another state. We have that within our country.
Different ethnicities. Right, exactly. Well, you know, let me just give you one anecdotal thing. One reason I know about this, my dad was pretty well read, and I just remember in the 50s he told me, you know, they made a big mistake with the Slavs. They should have enlisted the Slavs. And I think I remembered that all through my life, so I sort of picked up things all along the way. And but now the problem is we've got to resolve this question. And there are things about the Slavs. I mean, you do see some Russians who definitely have a Slavic look, and they're not necessarily Jewish. In fact, they often aren't. But and then you see other Russians that look like they're from Sweden, and they do have the same genetics. So, but they call them Slavs. So I just wonder if this whole idea of Slavs has to be redefined such that it's not so genetic, that there's a better way differentiate.
Slav is a language. It's a
exactly.
language group, and you have many races
That's right.
In there. And when you add them all together, you go all the way to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then that another thing is this pan-Slavism movement that started in the 1800s. And, you know, I mentioned earlier in the program that you didn't hear that your caller, Alex, and your friend who called you yesterday on your program said that when you mentioned the Slavic problem, he saw it as the divisions amongst the Slavs between the Poles and
exactly.
Russians and the Croats and Croats and Serbs and so on, rather than between. And so that comes from that general feeling that Slavs have, that they're one group, they should organize, they have this power group, and that puts them at, you know, and somewhat against the West, you know, and they, at that time, the whole idea of Pan-Slavism was to move into the West, take it over, take over whatever part they wanted. So, you know, there's that, too. So you say, well, they're all different. I agree with you. They're so darn different. I don't think they can all be put under some umbrella, but there is a movement to do that.
Carolyn, though, I don't think he was mentioning that as being a staunch pusher of the Pan-Slavic movement. I think he mentioned that just to show here's another division, and it's a problem. And because I also brought up the difference between Slavs in general, which are considered a genome, which they really aren't. It's like Marcus said, it's a language group. But you think of it, though, as a genetic way. And we have to resolve the whole thing, clear the whole thing up as much as we possibly can, because I think it's one of the critical problems that's lasted for really a long, long time.
Yeah, the problem is really just that it's supposedly that Hitler was this big anti-Slav. I mean, he allied with Slavs wherever he could, including the Ukrainians. He just did it the legal way, with the Waffen-SS and not accepting deserters. You see? It's the same.
Well, I don't see.
I
don't see, Marcus. I don't see. In a war...
It's the same in France.
Well, I don't see, though. In a war, you have to do things because you have to win the war first.
That's
a number one. I'll take my opinion to win a war over anybody's that backs off at all. War is ruthless. All is fair.
Yeah, but
all
okay,
is fair
maybe,
in war.
Yeah,
people that go according to the rules.
Okay, maybe you can criticize that, but that has nothing to do with the Slavic question, because it was the same
Stepan
thing
Bandera
in Belgium.
Was another. Stepan Bandera
was
another one.
It was the same thing in Belgium and France.
You know, they had Stepan Bandera in a concentration camp. They weren't as convinced that he was an answer for them as you are and as people seem to be now.
Well,
there was a lot of questions, and I don't know what they all are. I'd like to
I don't know
where to find all that information, actually.
Stepan Bandera, if you went through my blog there, Matt Johnson has some very good stuff.
Yeah, he
that.
Does, I guess, but I've never been a fan of Matt Johnson, and
he's
biased.
Well, of course he is.
He's kind of biased.
Everybody's biased. Everybody's biased.
This whole thing has to do with the overall, you know, the takeover of Europe. Well, when Germany went into Denmark, Denmark was still a functioning country. It was a democracy, and it had their king. Germany just had certain rights in Denmark. Based on the charter of the Hague Convention. That's it.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't want to recite
people want to make this, well, Hitler took over all of Europe.
No.
You know,
what I want to do is resolve
of it.
Marcus, what I want to do is resolve the Slav question as much as we can so that it is not an easy tool of division such that it is now. Boy,
well,
it's really
you know,
easy.
you seem to think that we can just resolve the Slav question by talking about the Slav question, I guess. I think it's kind of related to a lot of things.
Well, of course it is, but I wouldn't concentrate too much in any one area. Sure, we can argue all night about whether Hitler this or that, and we may make comments, but then you go on and bring in other predicates, and that's where I'm not at. And you said, well, I just stopped there. Well, it's because I don't know a hell of a lot about it. I do know some things, but it's spotty, and I have friends that happen to be Slavic on two sides of the real divide, one from the Roman Catholic Polish side of Slavs and the other one from the Orthodox Serbian side of Slavs. At least those are two almost diametrically opposed camps there, and if I can get those together, I'll learn a lot, and I think we can learn a lot
from
that. Is
that Daniel who you're speaking about, or somebody else,
the Polish? Daniel on the Polish side, and then my friend Alex on the Serbian
Orthodox.
Is Daniel
a practicing Roman Catholic?
I don't think so, but he is a staunch Polish nationalist. Well, obvious what he is, and I have my disagreements, you know, somewhat, with his perspective too, but I'd like to learn more about it.
We can solve this out, but you have to see the bigger picture. You know, if you accept Austrian troops in the Balkans to have a fortress against the Ottoman Empire, if you don't have that, then you have the Balkans. You have all these little nations, and the Ottomans, they can just rush over it.
Well, that's another predicate that we maybe should bring in, but that's just one minor predicate of things that happened 100 years ago, leading up to World War One, I believe. So,
I think the enemy media is just hyping the whole thing. How is this resolving anything?
Yeah.
Well, look,
but anyway,
I'm glad you called in, Bob. You know, I would be willing to host a kind of a round table continuing on this Slavic question with your friend Daniel. But the only thing, I'm very limited now with only being able to take telephone calls. Now, you guys are both calling with your Skype accounts. That's good. I guess if people can, or if some people have unlimited phone, you know, accounts, unlimited minutes, and so they can call in. But that's the only way I can have guests now is through a phone call due to problems, due to limitations of Blog Talk now. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No, then we have to solve the issue of prosperity. You know, if Eastern Europeans come to the West for prosperity, we can also think, well, then let's bring in some of our in the Western elites to the East, or just close the borders, and the West will be prosperous, and the East maybe too. Who knows? Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
You know? But you can't have it one way. That it's okay for all the Easterners to come into the West, but no influence of the West in the East. So you have to make a compromise there, or don't. But you can have it both ways, right?
Well, I'm not even. That's another predicate that could be brought in. But again, that's just one thing to consider when developing a concept of just what is a Slav. Now we know it's a language group, so then we have to develop it down to a genome or various genomes. That is going to take some time. And what I want to do is I want to meet with my friend Alex first, I think, and we'll just have informal, and then I want to meet with my friend, you know, via Skype, with my friend Danny, and just keep it informal and put things together so that we have topics that will get us to some reasonable possibilities of coming up with fairly good representations of reality. Right
well,
now,
we're
just
saying,
bringing predicates in from every place.
Are you
saying
that...
You can always...
you see,
go ahead,
Carolyn.
Okay, thanks, Marcus. Are you saying, Bob, that your main idea is what is the genetic makeup of Slavs And if they're the same or something not very different from Western Europeans, that means we're all the same or something.
You're looking at it as a monolith. No, that's one part of it. And we're bringing in predicates from here, there, and everywhere in a scattered fashion, in a shotgun fashion. So you can't get any place. I mean, you can knock down any argument, almost any argument about almost any topic, doing it that way, because there's always something out there.
History and what people have accomplished over time is a tremendously convincing argument, and it means a lot, as we know, amongst people. We know that racially. We talk racially. What?
Yeah. I don't want to be offensive. No, I know. I'm going to send you a YouTube of a Russian. It's all in Russian language, but they did sort of a crude subtitle in English on it. But it brings up a totally different facet. I'll bet you've never seen it before about history of Russia. It could be wrong and obviously biased.
Oh, I may have seen it. I may have seen it. I've seen some of those things.
Is it the one about Ivan, what we call Ivan the Terrible?
I don't know. I don't even remember it, but it was supposed to be the real history of Russia or something. Go ahead. Yeah, do that.
It's a fairly short one, but the point is it goes into an aspect of Russia that even from their biased perspective, you can see this thing goes way back, 400 or 500 years, the east-west, and I mean east being Russia, not east being China, the east-west thing, and some of the background behind it, and the British tactics, the British intelligence service tactics that were even used 400 or 500 years ago.
Intelligence services better than the Russians. Yeah, I did bring that up on Saturday, and as good as the British are, the Russians put everybody to shame. But anyway, I guess we should close this program. Do you have either one? Do you have any last words you want to say?
Well, I'm looking forward to that roundtable. Maybe with Alex, I know him a little bit, and he is a Serbian nationalist. And I respect him very much, but he himself lives in Western Europe. So let's see what he has to say.
Okay, well, I'll see if you want to do that, Marcus. I'll see what I can get together. I don't know what Bob is doing his own thing there, but
might
transmit that to Alex, Bob, that Marcus would like to have us.
Well, what I'd rather propose at this time is I'd like to talk to Marcus for a while. After I listen to tonight's show, obviously, the whole thing, I'd like to talk to Marcus for a while, maybe via Skype and at his convenience. And I want to do the same thing with Danny and Alex and get some kind of an agenda which will be, you know, much more organized, which will come to some conclusions, some possible conclusions, or at least places that we can go and discuss without rancor, or at least not too much. But I'd like to do that first, before any roundtables, because a roundtable, you have to come at quite a high level to do something good in a roundtable. I worked at Ford Motor Company, and their committee system was just ridiculous. It never got anything done. So if you don't come in at a very high level, they don't get much done, you know, it's too easy to bring predicates in that shouldn't even be brought in, that are important maybe, but they shouldn't be brought in because they take the vector of the discussion in a totally wrong direction from the solution you're looking for. So that's what I mean. I think we got to come in at a higher level, but I like the idea.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for calling in, Bob, and I really do appreciate it. I think this is program has turned out to be a lot better than it was if it was just me finishing up my thing I had here to read. So I appreciate it very much. And we'll talk again. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay, Marcus, you have any last-minute words you want to say before we end the program?
Yeah, I would rather like to speak to a real poll. Someone who is really from Poland to discuss this on the Polish side. then,
you know, I had a real Pole on I interviewed him a while back, and I did try to connect with him recently to ask a question or ask a favor for Eric Hunt, but I didn't get it. I have his email, his Skype address, but I didn't get a response back. Anyway, I don't know. But he wrote a book. He's quite the writer. He's quite the Polish patriot and so on. So do you have some? Do you know some Poles? There's Danny. Danny's not a real Pole.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
He's American, and
right.
He has, he has his opinions, and that his Polish side may play a role, but that is not really a Pole. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also have, I'm pretty much, I've had with him discussions and.
Yeah. I don't know. I could try to get hold of this this man again, but you see, I can't do it with Skype unless I do some fancy footwork here. I might be able to figure it out. I have to talk to Paul Hickman again. So anyway, I guess we better bring this program to a close.
All right.
And I appreciate your input. It was very valuable, I thought.
Yeah, it was nice talking to you. And,
okay.
I always appreciate your programs. I don't agree on everything, but that doesn't really matter. You know, the effort counts, and all your available knowledge and your opinions attached to that, I always enjoy.
Okay, thank you very much, Marcus. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this program, and. I think that the callers added quite a bit to it, so I'll just let it go at that, and I'll just say this has been Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on October 6, 2014, and saying good night for now, and see you next time.